Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Martin Tanner, co-hosting with Bruce Webster. Our Come Follow Me topic today is insights into Doctrine and Covenants sections 115 through 120. Before we begin, please know that the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the church through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in the form of articles, seminars, films, roundtables, and all kinds of different resources. We invite you to see everything the Interpreter Foundation has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. Interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it and consider giving us a 5-star rating. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned by the church or controlled by it, we are solely responsible for the content of our message today. And now, Come Follow Me, topics 115 through 120, and Bruce Webster, who is joining me, will provide some background information.
Okay, we're in spring of 1838, and this is a very critical and tumultuous time for the church. The church has basically, in the process of leaving Kirtland, has been driven out of Jackson County and are settling in far west for now. You have significant apostasy among the leadership of the church. Those who are have become increasingly hostile and even threatening towards Joseph Smith and those who follow him. Others who have simply left the church, and this is a delicate time for the church, and it's interesting that turns out to be pivotal in several significant areas. There are brief passages of scriptures here that are directly relevant to the church today, as we'll see. So let's start with section 115, April 26th, and the Lord is telling them about, here is what I would like you to do in Far West. And spoiler alert, they don't get to do this. They get driven out of Far West as well. But, and this highlights what the Lord does. In fact, in another section of D&C, he says, you know, I command, and people don't do what I ask, and because of that, the blessings are often revoked. So you're going to have continued dissension within a church, but with that, you're also going to have those who are very dedicated to the church, who are doing their best to accomplish what the Lord asks, and they will lay the foundation in these five or six sections here. You will see a lot of the foundation laid for the modern church here. And we can start right off the bat with D&C 115, which does something that President Nelson reemphasized just a few years ago. The Lord says, "For thus shall my church be called in the last days, even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." Up until now, the church had gone by a number of names, most notably the Church of Christ and so on. But here he's giving the church a very specific and explicit name, something that will distinguish them. It's quite different from any of the Protestant and certainly the Catholic churches that are around. And what's most telling is right after he says that comment, it gives that command, he says, "Verily I say unto you, arise and shine forth that thy light might be a standard for the nations." Okay, 17 million members worldwide, 200 plus temples in operation, over 100 more, almost 200 more, announced or under construction. The Lord is laying the groundwork here for the fulfillment that we're seeing literally in the last days here, almost 200 years later, a little less than 190 years later. And that's going to be true for other things we are going to see here and see the reaction to it. So that's a good context for all these sections. And with that, I'll kick over to Martin for observations and
Okay.
pointing out scriptures and so on.
Thank you. The official name of the church is a fascinating topic because if you go back to New Testament times, there are several places in the book of Acts and in other writings, particularly of Paul, where we see that the name of the church doesn't contain the name of Jesus. They called themselves not early Christians or the Church of Christ. They called themselves followers of the way, meaning the way that Jesus taught. And as I've reflected on why the different names in the early days of Christianity and today, it's easy to grasp the fact that when Jesus first started his church, it was instantly known that he was the focus and that it was his church. And there were, at least for a time until the beginnings of the apostasy, no other competing Christian churches. But in the latter days, when the gospel was restored, we have a very different circumstance, and that is that there are already hundreds of churches that profess to be the Church of Jesus Christ. And so this elegant name that has been chosen here by the Lord and designated in verses 3 and 4 to be the official title of the church are really profound because it's the Church of Jesus Christ, which, if just left there, would have been accurate, but surely wouldn't have distinguished the current church from many others who bear the name of Christ. There are several Church of Christ that are floating around out there. Of Latter-day Saints alone would not designate that it's a Christian faith. And so when you combine the two, you have the full package. You know that it's the Church of Jesus Christ, and it's also of the Latter-day Saints. Some people find it a bit odd that we call ourselves the saints, but not only was that designated by God here in the Doctrine and Covenants, but it also reflected those who felt like they were following the will of Christ. They were called informally saints during the time of Christ. And as a matter of fact, those who were looking forward to Jesus when he first came often called themselves the Latter-day Saints, meaning that they were in the last days and before the Messiah came. And they felt like they were the saints of God waiting for the Messiah. Anyway, that's probably a bit more trouble than we needed to go into, a bit more detail than we needed to go into. But this is an important thing and not something that we should look at casually, the name of the church. The other quick comment that I have here is about the necessity in verse 5 of the church is supposed to be a standard for the nations. Now, this may make a lot of sense for us today, but at the time that this was given, which was in 1838, the church had a bit of a stronghold, a tenuous one, in the United States and had some presence in England, but it was far from a worldwide church. It was not even a large Christian denomination. And so, only based on the revelation of God would a young church be so willing to do what's mentioned there in verse 5, to be a standard for the nations. That's quite an amazing statement to have such a small group proclaim that to be the case. And yet they do. It's wonderful. And as Bruce has mentioned, the saints are commanded to build a house in verse 8, and that does not all work out well, but they, at least many of them, do their best and work very hard at it.
Yeah. The total population of the church around this time was somewhere between 17 to 18,000. And as Martin has said, most of that was in the United States. We don't have the tremendous explosion in England that's going to happen subsequent to this when the 12 go to England on a mission. But the saints here are commanded to build a house. They actually do this ceremony. It's a big ceremony on July 4th, 1838, with a lot of pomp and circumstance. And then the saints get driven out of Far West. And I think this will probably be covered in later podcasts. The final dedication of the cornerstones will occur in 1839, just before the 12, as a body, start to head over to England for the tremendous missionary work that happens there. I don't have anything more for 115. How about you, Martin?
I am good with that as well. We should move on to 116.
116 is a fun one. This is one of the ones that saints like to get wrapped around. Adamondiamon, and the prophecy that Adamondiamon is there in Spring Hill, Missouri, and it's where there will be a great meeting with Adam. He will visit his people in the last days, as spoken by Samuel the prophet. This is one of those little tidbits that we as saints love to speculate on. I've seen video podcasters who, raise the question, has meeting in Adamondiamon already occurred? And it's I suspect Martin has far more he can say on this subject in terms of both scholastic and historical investigation on it. Take it away, Martin.
Well, the whole issue of what is going to happen at Adamondiamon and the context of it all is really pretty fascinating. Section 116 is taken from an entry in Joseph Smith's personal history, which was placed in the Doctrine and Covenants in 1876 under the direction of Brigham Young. So this was originally a diary entry. And in it, Joseph Smith says on May 18th, I left Far West in the company of Sidney Rigdon, Thomas B. Marsh, David W. Patton, Bishop Partridge, Elias Higbee, Simeon Carter, Allinson Ripley, and many others for the purpose of visiting the North Country. And then it goes on, and the next day it talks about pitching their tents and forming a line and marching and crossing what they called the Grand River at the mouth of Honey Creek. And from there, they reached this little location where there is a tower, kind of a tower, the foot of a Tower Hill, and it was named that as a consequence of this altar appearing structure that was made of stones. And according to some of the entries, this was an ancient Nephite altar. According to other statements, it was something that was placed there by others. In other words, there's a little bit of uncertainty with this, but the point is that this was a real inspiration for the early church members. And about it, Joseph Smith, when asked, said that this is Spring Hill, quote, but by the name of the Lord, it was named Adamondiamon because It is the place where Adam shall come to visit his people, where the Ancient of Days shall sit, as spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Close quote. If you want more details about that, go to volume 3 of History of the Church. Start on page 34. This is something that, as Latter-day Saints, it's a focal point, and it's the focal point of the idea that the church eventually will be centered there in the area in and around Adam on Diamond, and not necessarily Salt Lake City forever and ever. One of the other points to be made here is that there are a number of details about the purpose of this grand council, which is a fascinating thing. And Joseph Fielding Smith talked a bit about this and said that it will be of great importance to the world, and that at that time there will be a transfer of authority from Lucifer or Satan to King Jesus Christ. Those are his words. Not mine. And the essence of this is that apparently symbolically and also in a very real sense, this will be the time at the beginning of the millennium where the power is taken away from Satan. His power will be reduced and taken away, and Jesus Christ will reign. Then at the end, of course, of the millennial period, Satan will be loosed again for a bit. But if you've ever wondered, well, wait a minute, how are we going to just instantly have goodness in the world? Well, one of the ways is that power will somehow actually be taken away from Lucifer, according to Joseph Fielding Smith. One of the other fascinating points about Adam on Diamond is that it also happened during a time when there was some serious turmoil in the church. Verse 11 is sometimes overlooked or just skimmed over because people don't quite know what it means. It says, quote, "Let my servant Newell K. Whitney be ashamed of the Nicolaitan band and all of their secret abominations." Exactly what this was, we do not know, but the Nicolaitans were a group in the early Christian church. They're talked about in Revelation chapter 2 in verses 6 and 15. And they were apparently, well, their name comes from Greek words meaning over people or presiding over people. And so the gist of it, the idea is that there was a group in the early Christian church who thought they were better than other groups and tried to preside over and lead them. And they were known for being authoritarian, and they were also known for promiscuity, to put it bluntly. And so whether or not the group that Newell K. Whitney was involved with was quite as bad as the early Christian group, he's sort of slapped down here in verse 11 and put in his place. But of course we know that Newell K. Whitney has a great future in the church, and so he must have done as the Lord requested here. Back to
And
you.
it may be tied to one of the issues that was going on here is the church. The Lord instructed the church to start to dispose of properties in Kirtland, and there were this was a time of some real financial hardship. There was a national, I mean, there was a national depression. It hit national bank failures. We talk about the Kirtland Safety Society, but there were banks failing all over the U.S. And the gathering in Ohio, you had the spiritual high of the dedication of the temple, the visitations that occurred there, and then things started to sort of fall off, and you had the problems that occurred in Missouri in Jackson County, at least some of which were due to real estate speculation and self-dealing on part of church leaders who should have known better. And I don't mean Joseph Smith, I mean some of the other leaders of the church there. So in 117, you have the Lord saying, sell the properties in Kirtland, get out of debt. It may be that the slap here towards Newell K. Whitney, the rebuke, is that he may be more concerned about personal finances and aggrandizement than following the Lord. And as Martin pointed out, Newell turned out to be very faithful and very dedicated to the church. Oliver Granger had the real hard job, which was that he had to stay behind in Kirtland and try to wrap up the church's financial affairs, and was very faithful and diligent in doing that. Section 118, we have some apostles who have apostatized, and the Lord basically gives instructions to call for those who are there, and this is where you have the prophecy of the having the apostles take leave to go to England, and they're supposed to leave from the temple site in Far West on the 26th of April of the following year at the temple site, and they end up doing that despite the fact that this is a known revelation and that there are enemies of the church who are seeking to stop this from happening. It does, in fact, happen. It's a good time to plug the book Men on a Mission by James, with James Allen. The story of the apostles' mission to England, which was profoundly, profoundly important to the ongoing growth and vigor of the church, and really turned the 12 into a quorum ready to take over from Joseph after Joseph is martyred. It's one of the most important missions in the history of the church. As per Martin's comments, there was actually a point when there were more Latter-day Saints in England than there were in the U.S. The level of conversion was so significant. And those were a lot of the pioneers who crossed the plains at great sacrifice and gathered. They gathered first in Nauvoo and then were continuing to gather and gathering all the way to the Rocky Mountain West. Anything more you want to say about 17 or 118, I mean?
A couple of very quick things.
Okay.
In verse 2 of 118, it says, "Let my servant Thomas remain for a season in the land of Zion to publish my word." And you can read right over that and think, what in the world is he talking about? And then you go, I don't know. And you keep move on to something else. But what's going on here is that Thomas B. Marsh was publishing the elder's journal. It's a responsibility that he had for a while in Kirtland. And although the elder's journal was kind of a short-lived publication, it only ran from October of 1837 to August of the next year, so not even a full year. Some of the information in it is wonderful, and it also speaks to the importance that the Lord has continuously had since the restoration of the gospel and the formation of the church in 1830 to keeping a record of everything that happens. And so, section 118, verse 2, little footnote to that very idea. That's it for 118 for me.
Okay, 119 and 120. Now, this is laying the financial foundation for the church. Up till now, the church has been living under a law of consecration of sorts. And there's a great book by Lyndon Cook that talks about, we confuse some of the sections that we're talking explicitly about the members, and then those that we're talking about certain select groups of leaders who were basically bonding together to do things such as the printing for the church and so on. But we have 119 where Joseph Smith specifically asks, this is now in July, show unto thy servants how much thou requirest of the properties of thy people for tithing. And as a heading and other documents show, at this point, tithing was just thought of literally as a general term for contributions, passing the plate around, dedicating stuff, and so on. But we get an explicit definition here that says that it asks for surplus properties to be donated initially, and then those who've been thus tithed shall pay one-tenth of all their interest annually, and this shall be a standing law unto them forever. Interest is defined by the church to simply mean income. And the beauty of tithing is that contrary to some truly bizarre anti and ex-Mormon tweets I have seen online, the church does not ask for your W-2s. The church does not audit your finances. The church does nothing to verify your tithing status. Tithing declaration is simply going into the bishop and saying whether or not you are a full tithe payer. Church doesn't define whether it's net or gross. Church doesn't define whether or not you pay tithing on Social Security or not. And as has been pointed out to members, particularly members in the US who have some very rigid, this is exactly what it is. I've seen comments by saints who live in other countries, particularly in Europe, where the tax rate is such that a tithing on gross income would basically wipe out a lot of their income, because the government tax rates are so high. So this is the all the anti-attacks saying, oh yeah, the church, you're going to hell if you don't pay tithing, or the church audits you, or they won't do stuff with you. We're back to what you feel you should do to keep your standing before God, and then you simply make a declaration to your bishop if you're asked, and that's it. So it's a beautiful principle. It wasn't this one that wasn't widely followed, and then was re-emphasized by Lorenzo Snow. Martin and I are old enough to have watched the old Windows of Heaven movie about Lorenzo Snow dealing with strapped church finances and going around to the saints and pleading with them to start living the law of tithing, and the help that was. And likewise, we have, given how the church finances have struggled all the way up into the mid 20th century, I find it amusing how many people are angry or concerned at the financial resources the church has managed to build up over the last 50 years, 60 years, really. And often are oblivious to the fact that the church literally has tens of thousands of buildings and other facilities that it needs to maintain, support, take care of, and so on. Anyway, so that's my first take on this. Martin, your comments on, and then what I'll simply add to lump it together. Section 120 defines who decides how tithing is spent. And this is the Council on the Disposition of Tithes, which still exists today. It's currently constituted by the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve, and the Presiding Bishopric. Anyway. That's my comments here. Martin, up to you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. One of the things that has always been emphasized by the church ever since Franklin D. Richards first spoke about this in 1882, when he said this, quote, "Let us consider for a moment this word surplus," when he's talking about in section 119, verse 1, "I require all the surplus property to be put in the hands of the bishop of my church." Well, what does surplus mean? The obvious point made by Franklin D. Richards is that surplus, quote, "cannot mean that which is indispensably necessary for an important fundamental purpose to survive, especially." And then the survival part I just put in there for clarification. But he continues, quote, "But what remains after supplying what is needed for that purpose?" And so in other words, tithing is vital to the church, but tithing is not something that we're required to do if it is going to somehow, at a certain instant in time, be a huge damage to someone financially. We're supposed to use prudence with tithing. We believe that we will be blessed if we pay our tithing. And what tithing is in the sense of how it is calculated, as Bruce points up, is based on the honor system. And it's worked quite well. And let your conscience be your guide. And that's something that we all do according to our conscience and our belief in God. But it's been a wonderful program. It's allowed the church to actually be able to do a great deal of good in the world, especially recently, with helping those who are hurt by various circumstances of life. And so the church blesses so many people with tithing, and it's something that is used very carefully and only, as Bruce said, when there is some kind of consensus with the first presidency and the presiding bishopric. It's in the Council of the Twelve.
And to that end, because of the church's wise management and wise investment, the church is now spending over $1 billion a year in humanitarian aid. They are directly blessing, and the vast majority of that goes to people outside the church. The church partners with dozens of other organizations often run by other denominations, particularly hand in hand a lot with the Catholic Church. The church is famous for being, in many cases, the first on the scene in the case after a natural disaster or other calamity with relief efforts, supplies, food, clothing, things like that. When I was on my mission, I arrived down in Honduras in November of 1972, and a month later, a massive earthquake hit Managua, Nicaragua, the capital city, killed about 5,000 people and pretty much leveled the city. And the church was literally one of the first organizations on the ground in Managua with relief supplies. I knew elders who were there at the time who said they basically were working full time helping to unload supplies as they came off of planes that the church had chartered and then distributed to people within the city. So this is, as it's also pointed out, the church spends about $1 billion a year on education as well. running its universities, and most notably now BYU Pathway, which is may be the single largest educational institution within the church, if it isn't already, and may surpass the total enrollment within 10 years, may surpass total enrollment of all the other church, particularly in developing countries and nations. So these it is interesting for me to note, and again, for people who either in or out of the church, oh, they're just doing get rich. None of the general authorities get rich being a general authority. There are a number who are rich before they're called, and then they don't get anything from the church. The actual salaries are from what's been reported over the years, it's about on the line of what my 40-year-old daughter, who works as a senior software engineer, makes. These are not these, multi-hundred thousand dollar executive salaries that you typically see at most nonprofits and so on.
Right.
They are modest salaries, and it's modest salaries for a absolutely grueling workload. I have not interacted directly with the leadership of the church, but I have had friends and acquaintances who've been aware of their schedules and say you would not believe what these leaders go through, the number of hours per week that they put in, and often, particularly when you're talking about the first presidency at the 12, at a very advanced age. I remember reading the biography of President Kimball in his during his presidency. And he would sleep 4 to 5 hours a week. People who were traveling with him would often get exhausted because he'd be up to midnight and get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and have a breakfast of bread and milk and then keep doing stuff. And those around him had a hard time keeping up with him. So it's important to know that the stewardship is careful. Everything is audited. Speaking as someone who has been a stake auditor and been on the stake audit committee, the church scrutinizes every expenditure and tracks every penny, quite literally. It's why you literally cannot point to any financial scandal within a church. No self-aggrandizement, no enriching. And it's also one of the fastest ways to get yourself excommunicated. I dealt with that personally about 20, gosh, how long? 20, 25 years ago. I was in a bishopric in Washington, D.C. And Lou Hampton, the bishop, I was the counselor. Lou Hampton called me in and said, Bruce, can you come to my office? And I came in, and it was a someone from the church audit department. And he handed me a Xerox copy of two checks. This is back when all the checks were physical checks. You had this big checkbook with a register along one line, and you'd write out the check and tear it off. And he handed me a Xerox of these two checks, each for a fairly substantial sum, and said, "Is that your signature on these checks?" And I looked and said, "No, but it's not a bad forgery." It turns out a previous financial secretary had written himself two large checks, had signed the check, and had forged my signature. And this was unusual enough, it had been caught, not locally, but in Salt Lake. We were made to know that the church typically does not, in those cases, does not, or did not, at least at that time, pursue any criminal complaints. But the person would be excommunicated and could not be rebaptized without explicit permission of the first presidency. So there are, tremendous checks and balances on how tithes are handled. It's very carefully, and you really reconcile an award and a stake, you reconcile down to the penny. There is no room there for lining your own pockets. That's probably all I've got to say on all these sections. Martin, last thoughts or comments,
Perfect.
observations?
Well, last thoughts are that these are wonderful sections that actually give direction to the church at a time when it was struggling in many ways and enabled the church to move forward in some wonderful ways that might not have been intuitive without the inspiration of God. Join us again next time on the Interpreter Foundation's Come Follow Me. Martin Tanner and Bruce Webster signing off. Thanks for listening.